Okay, okay. Thank you. Thank you, see. Thank you. Okay. Now, you all know I hate to call another press conference. But I understand there has been some discussion, some controversy, about what beer I choose for this historic race discussion I am holding out on my patio. Let me be clear. This was not an easy decision. For example, I seriously considered Guinness. Black and white, together, you see? Smooth, dark, tall. It's my kind of beer. Some of my advisors suggested Dos Equis to make sure our Hispanic friends were represented at the table. And at one point I was leaning toward Kororo, the favorite beer of my home country of Kenya. Oops, okay, you didn't hear that. But anyway, in the end, I'll be enjoying a quintessentially American beer. Milwaukee's best. To choose anything else, well, that would just be acting stupidly, right? Okay. Anyway, Milwaukee's best. And bottoms up.
Oh, the beer. The great racial questions of our day reduced to basically tastes great, less filling. It's In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. And fortunately, here at In the Loop, we can have it both ways. We can have our fun and then have a real conversation. And that's how we're going to work it today. Big range of stuff coming up on the podcast. I think you're going to like it. Film, dance, architecture, listeners reciting poems they wrote about public restrooms. But first, let's hang with the Henry Louis Gates episode for a bit. The so-called Beer Summit unfolded in the White House Beer Garden. And all we know at this point is that Joe Biden showed up by surprise. So it must have been some kind of party. But as this one gesture gives way again to the broader conversation, I'm glad to be joined for a few minutes here at the start of the show by Ellis Coase. Ellis, thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be here, Jeff.
Ellis is a leading journalist on questions of race in America. He's a columnist and contributing editor for Newsweek. And back in 2002, a couple of books ago, he wrote a well-regarded essay called The Envy of the World, The Black Man in America. And Ellis, there's that phrase that's at the center of this whole thing. And Henry Louis Gates, you know, in this situation, in the heat of this moment, he doesn't just say, is it because I'm black? He says, is it because I'm a black man in America? Sort of a rhetorical flourish here. And I'm wondering what your take on it is. What's the implication of pulling out that full set phrase? What does it mean?
Well, I think it means a lot. I think part of it is almost psychological. And I think what it goes back to is something that a number of people have said as they've talked about this incident, which is that few black men in America have not had the experience of being unjustly hassled by a cop at some point. Clearly, once you look at the full story in its full context, it's much more complicated than just a story of some cop deciding to harass a black guy. And it's not even clear at this juncture whether his race had much to do with why he was singled out. But what's clear is that certainly Gates responded to it from both a personal history and a political history that has to do with the police and with blacks in America.
Do you know Henry Louis Gates?
I do know him, yes.
And I've seen his PBS specials. He seems like such an easygoing guy.
So. Well, he's, you know, he is. I mean, but I think also, as has been reported, I mean, he came back from this long trip to China. He gets back. He has a problem getting into his house. He finally gets into his house. And the next thing he knows, he's in a confrontation with a policeman. He clearly lost his temper. Had he had a chance to reflect on it more, he probably would have handled the situation differently. But also, it was, as he perceived it, a huge indignity to be arrested on your own porch after you've already identified yourself. I think for him, it had to make it even more galling.
Can you imagine that in that moment, though, given his life's work, that he might have sensed, I don't know, an opportunity, perhaps, or an injustice, maybe, where there wasn't one?
I think it's very easy to believe that he did. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that this incident just ignited America in terms of the internet, in terms of just conversations at the water cooler, is because being unjustly hassled by the cops is almost a universal experience for black men.
Have you got a recent experience that you immediately, put this in the frame of?
No, I certainly have a recent experience, but I've had experiences. I mean, I was once upon a time I was at UC Berkeley running a journalism program there, and I got pulled over by policeman after I had dropped off a colleague who happened to be a white woman. And when they pulled me over, they essentially told me that they suspected me of armed robbery, and they wanted to interrogate me until they saw my ID and realized I was connected with the university and had a nice position, and then the incident was diffused. But it's clear what they expected me, as I was a black man in an overwhelmingly predominantly white community. So sure, I mean, this is an experience, as I say, that in one way or another, virtually every black male has had, and so much so that many blacks are a little bit bewildered that Skip would even have responded the way he did, because it's just known you don't shout at cops when they confront you, because that often gets you in a great deal of trouble.
Is all the attention to this incident distracting us from the experience of people who maybe are not Harvard professors and who go through this every single day without having it make the national news?
Well, that's an interesting point, Jeff, and that thought occurred to me on several occasions since this, because we've had incidents where police have entered the wrong house and shot people, or as with Amadou Diallo here in New York, have shot black men who were unarmed because they thought they were carrying weapons, which have gotten nothing like the attention that this particular incident has gotten.
Right.
We are fascinated with status in this country, just in general. We're fascinated with celebrity. And here you have a well-known professor involved in an incident into which the president has injected himself. So it takes on a whole different meaning for people.
I'm white. I'm not a police officer. Putting aside the fact that I host the show and can do interviews about it, what can I do? I think a number of people are probably wondering that. Is there any role that they can play?
No, I don't think this is the kind of incident or the kind of issue that people on an individual level can do anything other than understand. In a fundamental sense, this is a question about racial profiling, police procedure, and perceived injustices between communities. That's not an individual set of issues. Those are a set of social and societal and political issues.
Ellis, it's been very good to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. You take care.
Ellis Coase is a contributing editor and columnist for Newsweek. His latest book is Bone to Pick of Forgiveness, Reconciliation, Reparation, and Revenge. He is also the host of a radio documentary series. It's called Against the Odds. Now, in addition to the Great Beer Summit, there was some other stuff getting done in Washington this week. Not healthcare reform. Apparently we're going to punt on that one and battle it out with television ads over the next month or so, which sounds like a very sound idea by everybody involved. But the Obama administration's so-called PAYSAR, this guy's name is Kenneth Feinberg. Well, he's finally buckling down to get to work. And his job is to go through the pay packages of executives and managers at all these companies that have been bailed out to some extent by the government over the past bunch of months. He needs to decide what goes too far, whose big bonuses need to be scaled back. Certainly secretive work. There's no results of anything so far. Delicate stuff, not exactly easygoing. And you would think it'll really take some guts to make the tough calls. So I was thinking, you know what they might be able to really use around the old PAYSAR office? A fight song or something like that. You know, just to get them revved up, give them fortitude for the task at hand. So I took a few minutes, put together kind of a little theme for the PAYSAR, and I hope they can use it. Here you go.
I will cut you. I will cut you.
Gave myself a little break on the lyrics this week, but nobody listens to the Gypsy Kings for the lyrics either. So there you have it, a theme for the PAYSAR. Hope they can use that, get them cranked up as they're digging into those executive pay packages. While we are still mentally and spiritually in the halls of Washington here, let's make the jump to our next segment. Just want to say thank you to listeners, all of you, and my colleagues in the building especially, who've been stopping by to let me know that there is a movie out called In the Loop. Maybe you might have all gotten together and decided you'd tell me all at once, but no, you want to tell me, you know, one by one over a period of many weeks. Lots of funny jokes there, and so that's cool. Anyway, if a movie has to sweep into town and captivate the world and borrow our name for a little while, at least it is a really good movie. If you haven't heard much about it, it's a very sharp, extremely profane satire about the British and American governments on the march to some vague Middle East war. Armando Iannucci directed In the Loop, and he co-wrote it. Armando, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yeah, we had a fantastic opening weekend. So, I'm just intrigued to see how it does, really.
And in a way, I'm glad, actually, that you used this title for the movie, because otherwise, In the Loop, it sounds like it could be kind of easy pickings as I don't know, like a Sandra Bullock romantic comedy or something.
Oh, right.
And now that's not going to happen, so I should thank you for that.
That's never going to happen. Unless, like, Crash. There's two Crashes, isn't there? There's Crash all about different stories in L.A., and then there's Crash based on the people who had a perversion about car crashes.
That's right. And a darn good thing we decided not to call our radio show Crash.
No.
So why did you call it In the Loop?
Well, it's fundamentally about people who think they are in the loop and then realize that the person they're talking to is completely out of the loop and has no influence and power. The idea that people feel that they are at the center of events and then discovering that they're really on the edge of events.
One thing that you've got here is kind of it's a portrait of the British-American relationship,
yeah.
Which is not as chummy and as comfortable as I think a lot of us, at least over here, would presume. You think in real life it's as rocky as you portray?
Well, it's sort of inspired by how, you know, Tony Blair and his entourage got rather starstruck when they came out to Washington, and they thought they were coming out to Washington to try and persuade George Bush to kind of slow down in his plans for invasion. But they got so overexcited, like little kids in Disneyland, that they completely forgot what their agenda was and just got rather giddy with excitement. I was saying to our British cast when we were filming the scenes in Washington, try and remember what it was like the first time you went out to L.A., and you met lots of Hollywood agents who told you all sorts of exciting things about how great you were,
mm-hmm.
and how you came away from L.A. with absolutely nothing. Because I think that's the feeling that a lot of U.K. politicians got when they came out. They felt they were making a difference and then realized that they weren't.
Now, I'm 31, and a lot of people who are my age and who I went to college with are now in D.C. doing something or other. And one of the things that I just really loved about the movie was how you wrote and directed the young American people, in particular the State Department staffers.
That was a big shock to us when I went out to D.C. and did my research for the film, that there are an awful lot of quite bright people in their sort of mid-20s who have an enormous amount of power. We met one 22, 23-year-old who was sent out to Baghdad to help draw up the Constitution. You know, he's drawing up the Constitution of another country.
Yeah.
Yet he's probably never really bought his own house.
And I really like the way that you sort of wrote them kind of sniping at each other. And
yeah.
I'm thinking of the man and the woman in particular, Liza and Chad, was it?
Chad,
right?
Yeah.
Where did you get your inspiration for the way that they talk? Because I'm not going to say it's realistic, because I don't think anybody's quite that sharp in real life.
No, well, we supplied them with funny lines to say, but in the first casting session where I met both of them, I sat both of them next to each other and said, right, insult each other. And they went on for about half an hour. You know, I just had to sit back and watch.
Hey, Liza.
Yeah, hey.
Hey, I just want to say congratulations. Your paper got a major citation. You must be psyched that Karen brought it up.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, her call, not mine.
You couldn't write a paper that clashes more violently with the current climate than the one you wrote if you were trying. And it seems like you almost were trying.
I wasn't trying. So,
okay.
Believe me.
You're like the woman from The Omen. You've given birth to a demon, and now it's going to kill you.
You probably identify with the kid from The Omen, right?
Ooh.
See, you're an only child, aren't you?
I gotta say, I don't understand how my parents' limited reproductive ability reflects badly on me. I'm the sperm that made it, so.
Liza.
I'm being called by our boss.
Oh, okay. Retreat.
Thank you.
See you later.
Yeah, have fun with yourself.
Okay, have fun with your career kryptonite.
Just so I have fair warning, if there's next time, are you planning an In the Loop Part 2? Is there a sequel or a prequel in the works?
Prequel? Oh, gosh. What, Liza and Chad when they were 12?
Everybody's doing prequels these days.
Or a reboot. So we do the exact same story, but with a completely different cast. I don't know. What, In the Loop credit crunch? In the Loop stimulus?
Yeah, depends what misadventures our two countries get into, I suppose.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Armando, thanks very much for taking a few minutes for In the Loop.
No problem.
Armando Iannucci directed the movie In the Loop, which is opening now across the U.S. It's based loosely on his BBC series, The Thick of It, and not at all on our show, but it is a very good movie. I'd highly recommend it. And in fact, Santa and I were thinking about maybe having kind of like an In the Loop listener meetup one of these nights for listeners who are here in the Twin Cities to go see the movie out at the Lagoon in Uptown, which is where I think it's playing. If you'd be up for that, let us know. We're trying to sort of gauge interest, and you can watch for details on our Facebook page. Loopfacebook.net is where that is. Moving along now, sort of watching the news this week and Facebook and Twitter, all the tweets and twits, seem like a meme that's been out there. A lot of people talking about it. Texting and driving. And that's largely because there was a new study that came out saying that we are 23 times more likely to get in a wreck when we're texting than when we're not. A bunch of states now have laws against it. New Hampshire was the latest just today, I think, to say, OMG, we got to do something about this. There's also a New York Times game, which is kind of fun, online game that a lot of people have been playing and passing around. Anyway, we asked our network, our email list a couple of days ago for their stories of close calls with texting and driving, kind of hoping that maybe we'd hear from somebody who had perhaps caused a close call of their own. We didn't get that. Those people are, not surprisingly, kind of shy. We did get some other interesting responses. One of those was Duke Powell. He is a paramedic ambulance driver in Minneapolis.
You'll have a bunch of cars in front of you. We display our red lights and sirens. Everybody will pull over either right or left, and you have one car that is not and just seems determined to stay in your way. And as you do maneuver around them, you look down and you can find that they're on the phone or they're texting. And they just were oblivious to the situation around them. It's dangerous for us. It's dangerous for the public. And this is just not an occasional occurrence. This occurs on almost every run that we go on. What is that person thinking? Pay attention to what you're doing. There's times where I would think, boy, I just wish I could just throw a paint balloon at their car to get their attention and just to pay him back for acting so unsafely.
All right. Thank you, Duke Powell, paramedic. And I think that sounds like the name of an awesome TV show, actually. Tune in next week for the continuing adventures of Duke Powell, paramedic. That vigilante impulse that he's alluding to at the end there with the paint balloons, that's an interesting image. Well, he can't really do anything about that, of course, from the seat of an ambulance, but Kristen O'Brien is one listener who wrote in who's doing her best to indulge the vigilante in all of us as a private citizen. She had a couple of texting near-miss stories, and so I called her up.
One was when I was on a bike, and I was biking in one direction, and I was watching this gentleman, and I was paying attention to him because there was also construction involved right where we all were, and being on the bike, obviously, I feel a lot more vulnerable because I have my kids with me. And this guy was driving towards me, very much visibly looking down essentially towards the gear shift, starting to drift into the bike lane on his side. Luckily, I was coming at him, so he wasn't drifting into me. But I started yelling at him. I mean, I started yelling, focus on the road, focus on the road. And he looked up, startled, because I'm like, as if I had interrupted some deep conversation with his lap. And and he pulled over, and he realized, though, I was yelling at him about texting, because I started, you know, texting with my thumbs and then waving my finger at him like a maniac. He pulled over, thinking, who knows, maybe I was telling him he had a flat tire, but when he realized I was chastising him, then he darted off. But, yeah, I mean, I could visibly see, easily see him, because I was on my bike, see him, you know, on his phone, checking his email or whatever.
And you take this seriously enough that you've got a bit of a vigilante streak to you now, right?
Well, I have spoken with the sheriff's office, and they said, well, you can't report somebody. I asked, can you write down the license plate, or can you put it in the record that you're responsibly driving? And they said, no, but you have to call us at the time. And so I have put the dispatch number, which is what they told me to do. I put the sheriff dispatch number in my phone, so if I see someone who is driving like a lunatic, I will call the sheriff's office, and hopefully the sheriff will send somebody to try to actually see it in person.
You get the sheriff on speed dial.
I do.
All right. Has anything come of that yet?
No.
But you're watching.
It's also like after 3 days of seeing three different people do maniac things, all of a sudden I can't find anybody. But
isn't that always the way?
I'm not actively seeking it out. I want to be prepared.
Right. Well, Kristen, you get your thumb on your button. There's work to be done.
Yes. It's the only thing. Maybe it just makes me feel better.
All right. Well, thanks very much for letting me give you a ring.
No problem. Good talking with you.
All right. Take care.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kristen O'Brien there, a listener here in St. Paul, I believe. Yeah, texting and driving. Don't do it. If you happen to have your own story where you texted while you were driving and you caused some bit of trouble, we would still like to hear from you. Go ahead and fill out our form at intheloopshow.net. So we are in the middle of kind of an artsy fartsy block of content here. You know, we had film with the In the Loop movie. Here we've just been discussing, this is a bit of a stretch, fine literature. But in any case, we got a couple more arts-related segments for you. Let's move on to dance, because Merce Cunningham died this week. And I know this is huge. He was like this massive figure in modern dance. But of all the arts, I would say that dance is the one that still just kind of stumps me. And I'll be the first to concede that I don't know enough to appreciate it. I don't. And so, I don't.
In that latest note to our network where we asked about texting and driving and all that, I also asked if anyone was willing to try to help me understand why Merce Cunningham was such a big deal. Linda Shapiro wrote back. She's a freelance writer and a former choreographer in Minneapolis. And Linda, thanks for coming on the show, and let's give this a shot.
You bet.
What should a non-dancer like me, and I'm going to warn you, it's not like I'm hostile to dance or anything, but I really just, well, I'll be the first to admit, I don't get it. What should I appreciate about Merce Cunningham?
Merce became a kind of seminal figure in dance because of his choreography, but also because of his philosophy about not just choreography, but the arts in general and how they interact and what they're for, and has significantly influenced the fields of dance, the visual arts, music, film, and video.
Well, let's explore that multidisciplinary stuff, because the choreography aspects of it might be a little lost on me, but I have a feeling like the other stuff might click a little more. What was Merce Cunningham's innovation in that space?
Well, along with John Cage, the composer who was his partner for many years, artistic and personal partner, Merce and John together developed a kind of philosophy of music and dance, which is that they're completely autonomous. We make dances to go with music, right?
Right, sure.
Well, Merce Cunningham and John Cage thought it would be far more interesting to try to separate them so that Merce, for instance, would create 20 minutes of dance, and John Cage would create 20 minutes of sound. Then these two would come together, oftentimes in the dress rehearsal, so that neither Merce nor the dancers, nor the musicians, would have seen the other aspect of the piece before that.
What's the implication of this, you know, taking two separate pieces of art and slamming them together?
The idea was that if you allowed each artist autonomy, it would kind of free that artist from the cliches of his own imagination. Whatever each artist did contributed to the piece in ways that were completely unpredictable. And the idea of unpredictability, of course, was another thing that was very important to his work and perhaps unique to it. He was a sort of pioneer of using computers in dance. Even before he used the computer to develop movement, he would develop movement himself and then mix it up, you might say.
Hmm.
You know, kind of like sampling.
So he would kind of take some of his basic elements and then remix them.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So was he in the dance medium kind of leading the way with that notion, you know, across the arts?
You know, your producer asked me about the influence on the world of Merce Cunningham.
Right.
I've been thinking about that a lot because, especially the younger generation, mm-hmm. but all of us are so used to, you know, checking out YouTube and, you know, you can, you know, you look at a million little video clips of this and that and it leads you to this and that or Facebook or, you know, any of these kind of websites. And we're used to this idea of, you know, a million different windows that are not always related, you know, and sort of going from this to this to this to this.
Absolutely.
Without any trouble and you know, multitasking and looking at many things simultaneously. And I think that he was just so ahead of his time, you know, to realize and to incorporate that into his art.
This notion of randomness,
yes.
of moving from one seemingly unrelated thing to another. Well, truly unrelated thing, not just seemingly.
Right, and multiple perspectives, you know, that kind of thing.
Huh.
Because it's such, you know, it's such an important part of life as it's really lived.
Hmm.
You know, that was another thing that for some people was difficult. He made, you know, what some people call pure dance. Didn't have a story, it wasn't about love or war, or, you know, it was sort of like a what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people who go to dance are very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, well, that's very postmodern, right? That you don't need you don't need a point of reference and, well, and in a way.
I mean, I think he heavily influenced, you know, a lot of postmodernism in dance and perhaps in music.
And right back to YouTube, I mean, that's what more postmodern experience is there than living in the world of some random thing created that you click on YouTube?
Hitting you in the face. Right.
Okay, from modern dance to YouTube, I think you've made a very grand effort here, Linda, and I'm grateful for it.
I should also say that I did study with Merce Cunningham in the 1960s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's okay.
How I really came to know him and his movement.
More an authority on it than even we knew when we got back in touch with you. So we're glad to make the connection. Thank you so much.
You bet. If this airs, when would it air?
Well, we are we're a podcast fundamentally, and we do in fact this, and we distribute all of our content in all of those thoroughly disaggregated ways that Merce Cunningham pioneered for us. It sounds like it'll be on Facebook, and it'll be heading out as a podcast to people who choose to have it funneled into their ears, sandwiched between two other completely unrelated things. And
great.
There you go. We've just illustrated the legacy of Merce Cunningham, I suppose. In a very meta kind of way.
You are Merce Cunningham.
We all are, aren't we, I guess?
Yes.
All right. Well, I don't know if that's going to get me out to a modern dance performance anytime soon, but it's gotten me closer.
Great. I'm happy to hear that, Jeff.
All right, Linda. Take care. Thank you so much.
You too. Bye.
Bye. That's Linda Shapiro in Minneapolis. She's a freelance writer and choreographer and apparently a new Merce Cunningham. So there you have it. And rolling right along with our little In the Loop Focus on the Arts, which we didn't plan, just kind of worked out this way. But let's talk about architecture. We have someone out in California, San Francisco. Her name is Ruth Knapp, who is an architect. And she's one of our news nichers, as we say, people who follow a particular area of the news that most of us kind of let escape our notice on a day-to-day basis and then drop by every now and then to fill us in. So, Ruth, we've got you into a studio there out in Berkeley, I think. So thanks very much for coming back on the show.
Very happy to be here.
You brought a couple interesting items for us to work through today. And one is taking place on the opposite coast from you. You've been thinking about this architect of the Capitol position.
Yes.
It's a job that I think most of us probably don't even know exists.
Well, this position of architect of the Capitol is an old position. I think it was originally established by George Washington. And at first it was just, you know, the person who was going to oversee the development of the Capitol buildings themselves. But now it's overlooking, you know, the Library of Congress, Supreme Court. It's some very important buildings.
And who's the architect of the Capitol?
It's a 10-year term, and it last expired in 2007. Congress has yet to name a successor. Just hasn't grabbed them as a high priority.
I gather there's important work to be done on the Architect of the Capitol agenda?
In addition to maintaining the existing buildings, they're also developing new facilities to accommodate tourists. The latest was a Capitol Visitor Center.
Very expensive one, as I recall.
Yes, it came in $356 million over budget. Ow.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 years late, so if you had a permanent successor, they would be speaking for their department and answering the tough questions as to why did we spend this much.
So the hope here is, of course, we can keep those buildings in D.C. from falling apart. You sent us a picture of a building in another part of the world that appears to be deliberately falling apart, or it's being built that way, right?
It is the Maha Nakhon Tower in Bangkok. Imagine, if you will, a 77-story glass tower. Imagine some of those pieces of glass and the spaces behind them torn away. The first thing that struck me when I saw it is that it was a picture from the show of Life After People, where they show buildings that decay after people have gone.
Like I Am Legend or something, yeah.
Exactly.
It's kind of cool looking. It's certainly distinctive, but I gather you don't like it very much as an architect.
Well, say there's a war near Bangkok and people are thinking about decay and destruction and all that. Are they going to want to look at a building that looks like it's already partially destroyed?
Like it's already been hit by a mortar.
Exactly.
Another thing you brought to our attention, there's a new list of the best public restrooms in the country.
I looked at the list on this site that's www.bestrestroom.com, and it's run by Cintas, which is a company that supplies maintenance products. And I guess they were all nominated from across the country, and then it was culled down to 10.
So what is the nation's top public restroom?
Well, the vote ends Friday, July 31st.
Oh, so we will find out who is crowned the best public restroom in America.
The one that I know and am partial to is Macy's Union Square in San Francisco. The women's restroom, you walk in and you're in a room that has chandeliers, a gilt ceiling, and you open up the stalls and they're all trimmed out in wood inside. And it's just very, very nice.
And now that we live in this world of GPS and everybody carrying their little iPhones and stuff like that, public restrooms have become somewhat more important, or at least people are focusing on them more than they have in recent years, right?
I mean, there's the immediate need. You've got to find a bathroom right now. So there's apps that are called Need to Pee Now. And
really?
Know, sit or squat, yeah.
Oh, okay, iPhone apps.
And then there's other websites that focus on bathrooms with ratings. And it sort of feeds into our need to, you know, share info and report finds. And
if you got to go right now, you can maybe choose from the four in your vicinity and pick the one that's actually going to be the most fun.
Or the most clean, or, you know, the most child-friendly, or, yeah.
One last thing that you, I think you just kind of wanted to rant about a bit, and so I'll let you go. As an architect, choosing paint names. And all of us in our houses have to deal with this. I, you know, recently moved, so we were doing some painting, and I went through sand in my shoes and white raisin. You know, and we can deal with the cutesy stuff as homeowners. It's different for you?
Imagine, if you will, you're standing in front of the board of your local transit agency, and you're designing a new train station, and you've got two colors of terracotta on your building. One of the board members comes up close to your color board and realizes that the dark one is called cappuccino muffin and the light one is called fuzzy wuzzy. Then they see this bright green that's called atomic vomit green.
No kidding.
These are actual color names.
This hypothetical is not so hypothetical in your world.
Exactly. And then they think, oh, well, this color's got to be safe. It's a nice, quiet mauve. And it's called dangerous robot.
Dangerous robot. That's an
dangerous robot.
That's Sandin's here in the room with you. Sandin, how do you like that paint name?
Sounds like my new room.
Sandin wants to paint his room dangerous robot. That's right up his alley. And is it just it's just embarrassing?
You know, you try, especially with a public facility, to embody qualities of timelessness and grace and beauty
and gravity. And,
yes, okay. And dangerous robot to me just does not speak of gravity. There are facilities, especially, you know, we're working on a teen center right now where dangerous robot would just be just right up the alley.
Yeah, if you're designing a new building for the Office of Robot Defense, then you want to choose your colors based on some different criteria.
Exactly.
Ruth Knapp in San Francisco, thank you very much for bringing us some recent thoughts from the world of architecture. This was fun.
Oh, this was great. Yes, thanks so much.
We're always looking for new listeners who might be able to do this news niche segment with us. It has to meet a certain level of, you know, interest for everybody else. But if you think you might fit the bill, track us down at intheloopshow.net and let us know who you are. Now, Ruth had an idea as we were getting ready to do this interview earlier in the week. She said, why don't you ask other listeners about their favorite public restrooms? So we put that question on our Facebook page. And lordy, lordy, people do like to talk about their favorite public restrooms. We followed up with a number of folks. You can go to our Facebook page, loopfacebook.net, to see all the responses. But we tracked down a couple of those specific folks and asked them to put in poetic form, which is our sometime thing that we do here at In the Loop, their odes to their favorite commodes. And believe it or not, I swear I didn't write that down. I just made it up this moment. But that's nice, isn't it? One of those odes came back from Jess Hendricks, who wrote about what is probably one of the most well-known urinals, I'm told, in Minnesota. This is at a bar called Stashews in northeast Minneapolis.
Stories were told of your greatness. Sneaking into the men's room, I witnessed a porcelain edifice, fine as a marble statue. Of course, I refer to the urinals at Stashews, with columns akin to a castle tower, sheltering users from a golden shower. Your majesty is a sight to behold, and your virtues I will always extol.
Ah, oh, we have such awesome listeners. Thank you. That's Jess Hendricks with the poem there. And sometimes it's not about the restroom itself so much as it is about kind of the right place at the right time, just that great serendipity of the perfect public restroom. And here's another testimonial along those lines, this one from Fran Sepler.
When I'm miles into my run hitting the wall, I get to St. Thomas right there in St. Paul. On a weekend morning, no one's around. This lone runner sneaks onto the grounds. In a huge building with unlocked doors is a bathroom with cool air and floors. The fixtures gleam. The water is cold. This bathroom is runner's gold. Grimy and hot, I now feel renewed. Thank you, St. Thomas, for use of your loo.
Thank you, Fran. That's Fran Sepler. Wasn't it just the last podcast I think I lamented that we wanted more women poets? Well, here we go. Just mentioned public restrooms, apparently, and the floodgates open. Finally, we have Alicia Hawkins, who wanted to share some poetic love for the public restrooms at Chicago O'Hare Airport, where they have, apparently, automatic toilet seat cover dispensers.
An ode to the O'Hare bathroom experience. Oh, O'Hare, I praise your sanitary sensibilities. In flight, I avoid the cramped facilities, looking forward to your seat covers. Wasteful? Oh, yes. But I energetically wave my hand in front of the sensor and watch the shower cap-like seat cover unfurl. And I sit. No hovering. Ah.
Indeed. That's pretty good. This is the first time that I've heard these since Sandin gathered them up. And Alicia Hawkins, thanks very much for that. And let me just say to all three of our poets here, thank you and my compliments on especially spirited delivery. That was great. You know, there was one more segment that, according to my rundown in front of me, I was going to pop into the podcast here today, but I'm going to hold it. I'm going to save it because, you know what, we don't need another segment right now. And this is a good one to bring to you next week, something to look forward to. I went out and did the second in my series of these things where I'm meeting people who have friended me on Facebook, but who I don't actually know. And it was a great conversation, and I'll look forward to bringing that to you, and you can look forward to hearing it. Right. Before I go, a couple of orders of business. First, the credits, of course. In the Loop is produced by Sandin Totten and me. And we do get some help from a young woman who I don't get to mention every week on the show, although perhaps I should. Anna Weggle, who helps us get our questions out to our listeners and all that good stuff. Anna, thank you very much. And then the very last item of business, need to issue an update. Some might say a correction to, well, a musical item, as a matter of fact, because circumstances have changed, sadly, for many of us. You may recall, a few weeks ago, we brought you this particular bit of sports news in the, in the style of the Beach Boys for some reason.
Brett Favre's gonna be a Viking.
Right. Well, as those of you who live in Minnesota know, despite published newspaper reports at the time and the fact that he put a deposit down on a condo in Edina, Brett chickened out. And so there will be no Brett Favre quarterbacking the Vikings, which probably also means no terribly exciting Viking season, I'm afraid. But the fact remains that we did issue our Beach Boys-style statement, and we need to issue a brief correction and amend that initial report. Here you go.
Brett Favre's gonna be a Viking.
No, he's not.
Well, I think we're all good here. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I'll talk to you next time.